This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
The oil and gas lobby came to us with money in their hands, and we said, take us. The political establishment here have been prostitutes to the oil industry, and not high-priced call girls, in many cases, cheap hookers.
From the high desert, from the dry falls of ages past, this is Alex Smith. We have a full menu of audio for you this week. You'll start out with the main course of the awful truth about the continuing BP oil disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. Director Josh Tickell joins us for a look at his dark reality pick, The Big Fix. Then we go to the coal disaster you never hear about. The government of India has teamed up with one of its biggest corporations to build the largest coal plants on the planet. Shoma Dutta reports from Delhi about the Tata Mundra mega plant, their lives and your climate, in one big story. I'll play you a fine activist song about GM foods and wrap up with more from my recordings of Dr. David Schindler's breakout speech against the Canadian tar sands. Bon appetit.
You say this is about all that's leaking each day, well, this little bottle of full of stuff?
That's all.
That doesn't seem that bad, honestly.
Beaches all along the Gulf Coast are clean, they are safe, and they are open for business.
BP station is just right across this cut.
I'm catching it right now.
They lied. It was bullshit.
The oil and gas lobby came to us with money in their hands, and we said, take us. The political establishment here have been prostitutes to the oil industry, and not high-priced call girls, in many cases, cheap hookers.
They come in at night, they lie in the bottom, but they spray in dispersants all over our shrimping grounds. I didn't know you could buy a branch in the military.
Oh, this is a mother load right here.
I think that we've all been poisoned, and this is the biggest toxic waste cover-up in America's history.
When we hear from the media, from the government, that the oil is gone, we're being lied to.
Behind the IRS, the collection of offshore oil field revenues and royalties is the second largest generator of money for the United States government.
BP is the single largest oil contributor to the Pentagon.
Today, the elected officials don't get elected unless they have huge war chests of money. Most of that comes from corporations, and almost all those corporations are closely tied with oil.
A handful of extraordinarily wealthy individuals and large corporations have a major, major, major influence over our political life.
If you continue to believe in the fiction of a democratic system, then you're wasting your time.
Everybody tells you the BP Gulf spill is over, the journalists have gone home, and they've been replaced with millions of dollars of advertising funded by BP. Come on down and enjoy the beaches. Even President Obama swims here with his kids. And buy our seafood, that's safe too, except it isn't true. And who says so? Filmmakers Josh Tickell and his wife Rebecca. Josh grew up in Louisiana. He became an early expert in alternative energy like biofuels. His veggie van crossed the nation powered by America's waste grease. That led to the movie Fuel. Last year, their new film, The Big Fix, won a standing ovation at the Cannes Film Festival. Fasten your seatbelts, listeners. We're going to pull away the curtains of some big cover-ups and big power. Josh Tickell, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it isn't really over. In the spring of 2012, an ABC affiliate, WEAR-TV, had a story saying parts of the Gulf of Mexico shrimping were closed because of small shrimp lesions, abnormalities. We saw the photos. We saw the videos of twisted shrimp. But the TV station took back the story and says now it was just routine. Would you talk to us about the safety of Gulf seafood?
Well, I'm not an expert on the safety of Gulf seafood, even though I grew up in Louisiana and we spent almost 2 years making this movie. What I can tell you is what we've gathered from our interview subjects, among whom are the largest producers of shrimp in America. So, you know, what they're saying is essentially the brown shrimp population in Louisiana in the shrimping waters has collapsed. They're still shrimping a little bit east of Louisiana. They're still shrimping a little bit west of Louisiana. But if you've ever seen a shrimp or a fish, you'll know that they don't know where the borders are. So the area around the oil spill, the fish and shrimp that are being pulled up from there have no eyes. They have lesions on their skin. They're malformed. And many of them have oil in their guts. We've seen shrimp shipped as far as Arizona filled with oil. So essentially, you know, it's a bit of a roulette game. And unfortunately, it's Russian roulette. We don't know what of the seafood that's going into the supply chain for human beings to eat is toxic and what is not toxic. It's not being tested. The only test that exists is a sniff test where the Food and Drug Administration of the United States of America has people in rooms that actually sniff fish. Now, somehow those people are supposed to be able to detect trace amounts of toxic materials. Now, I don't know about you, but when I smell fish, especially a number of fish, I can't tell the difference of a fish that's had some dispersant sprayed on it and a fish that hasn't. So this is all covered in our movie, The Big Fix, which comes out in June. But it's a situation where we do not know what seafood is toxic and what seafood is not toxic.
All right. Well, let's get back to the scene of this giant environmental crime. On April 20th, 2010, BP's giant Deepwater Horizon rig blows up and sinks. And pretty quickly, we find the Coast Guard and BP and some other government agencies showing up as partners on our TV screens. How did that power sharing begin?
Well, you've got to understand that when the oil spill happened in Alaska, the Exxon Valdez spill 20 years ago, the federal decision that was made after that spill was that the spiller is responsible for the cleanup of the spill, including the area around the spill, including any forces that may be necessary to clean up the spill. So essentially, it abrogates any responsibility or power that the federal government may have over a spill site. Well, you got to understand, Louisiana has thousands of miles of coast because it goes inland, it's tributaries, and all of it became BP's jurisdiction. But it didn't stop there. We saw, you know, a meeting in the Roosevelt Room, which is on whitehouse.gov, with President Obama sitting across from the chairman of the board of BP and the CEO of BP. And in that meeting, what was decided is BP would create a $20 billion claims fund. Well, they've been shelling out money to local tourism boards, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, in order to promote seafood and tourism. So we see all these ads, come down, we've made it right, white sandy beaches, come eat our seafood. And essentially, it's a massive media campaign that has completely disconnected itself from any science or research or actual circumstances. Unfortunately, we're seeing people in the Gulf still very sick, including visitors.
So, Josh Tickell, what provoked you and your wife into making a film about this spill?
I think we were just as disturbed as everybody by the photos and the images of that oil gushing into the Gulf of Mexico. But I grew up in that area. You know, I spent summers in North Florida on the coast there. I spent many a spring break there. I grew up in Louisiana in the water. You know, my family are Cajuns. So I have a deep and long connection to that area. And to think that this environmental disaster was happening, at the very least, required some documentation. Of course, when we went to Louisiana, the first thing we did was we went to the beach, and we dug under the sand, and we found a layer of thick black oil that was as deep as we could dig. So we immediately saw a smoking gun. It wasn't that there had been a metaphorical cover-up. You know, it wasn't that the people had covered it up, the law or the rules, with paperwork. There had been a physical cover-up. The oil spill had been covered with sand. And from that point onward, the documentary evolved over the next 18 months.
And you got right in there on some of the beaches where people weren't allowed to go, and you got some footage that the mainstream media has never showed us. How did you do it?
Dogged determination, I think. We used undercover cameras. We used thermal imaging. We used night vision. We used a lot of different equipment from different people, but we also just used a lot of brute determination, and we just went for it. And it didn't take long for a very different story to begin to emerge than what everyone saw on the TV screen.
And in your movie, The Big Fix, you show how the federal government is utterly dependent on the oil industry for funding in these hard times. Can you tell us about that?
one has to understand that the most lucrative form of funding for the federal government is the issuing of leases for offshore oil drilling. About 40% of domestic production, U.S. domestic production, comes out of the Gulf of Mexico. So when I say most lucrative, I mean, you know, the IRS is the number one source of income for the U.S. government. The second source of income is the issuing of leases for offshore oil drilling. The second source of income. But imagine the amount of infrastructure that the IRS takes. Tremendous amount of infrastructure. Versus issuing a lease for an offshore oil platform. A group of people review a document. That document contains some information about the area. If the document's satisfactory, they put a stamp on it, and they send it back to the oil company. Every barrel of oil sold from that lease then accrues money to the federal government. So for a very small investment, and in the case of the U.S. federal government, an almost dismissive investment, because they really don't review these leases very carefully. Otherwise, they would have never issued a release to drill in such a gaseous pocket as the Macondo well, where the Deepwater Horizon blew up and killed 11 people. You know, that's just disregard for human life. But that's business day and date for the federal government because the money is so good. And there have been so many articles written about what the former body that was in charge of this, the Mineral Management Service, they've renamed it now to make it look legitimate. But there were huge scandals in the 80s and 90s of Mineral Management Service executives taking cash from oil rigs and using it for drugs and prostitution. And some of those executives are still in power. So we see a very corrupt system that is awash in money, dependent on that money, and the race is rigged or fixed, as we say, in that the federal government has to get that money to operate. Without it, it can't operate. And to get it, it has to cut all of these corners and be very dangerous and basically disregard human life and ecological life.
And then we have a corporation whose income is as large as many governments of the world. When you started to look into BP, how big is it? How far does their reach extend?
Well, BP is one of the most profitable companies in the world, and it's of the most profitable companies. It's still one of the most profitable companies. So they say, you know, when you look at the world as a conglomerate of corporations, the two most profitable enterprises are drugs, namely pharmaceutical, but illegal drugs as well, and oil companies. So of the oil companies, BP vies for the number one slot. During the time of the oil spill, BP issued $10 billion in cash to shareholders. $10 billion. They still made profit the quarter that the oil spill occurred, and they've made profit ever since. So this is a company that is so massive that the largest oil spill in North American history barely made a dent in their world income.
And they're all over operating with Russia and with England, and they really are what a multinational is all about. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with guest Josh Tickell. We're talking about The Big Fix, a movie after the BP blowout in the Gulf of Mexico. So, Josh, we saw these news reports of President Obama taking his kids swimming in the Gulf now that it's all safe and cleaned up. What really happened there?
Well, everyone saw the image. It was an AP wire image. It went across all of the front pages of the newspaper. It was, of course, on TV, of President Obama swimming in the Gulf of Mexico. The reality is he didn't actually swim in the Gulf of Mexico. That's the first problem with the photo. He swam in St. Andrews Bay. It's a protected area. So there was a bit of inauthenticity in that he did that press junket, went down to Florida, and said, the beaches are clean, they're safe, and they're open for business. I don't know if no one informed Obama or if, you know, his staff purposefully did not let him see what was really going on. But what actually happened was it was a press tour, and the beaches were still covered in oil. But today, right now, as we speak, as we do this interview, there are still cleanup workers on the beaches in Louisiana. Portions of the beaches in Mississippi and Alabama are intermittently closed. I'm not talking about fishing grounds. I'm talking about the beach. So if the beach is being closed, you've got to wonder about the fishing. And now all of this is in context of our president, commander-in-chief, who went down there, said the beaches are safe, they're clean, and it's open for business. So at some stage, you've got to ask, who is President Obama actually working for? Because, you know, if I'm a citizen of the Gulf of Mexico or I want to visit a beach, he's sure as heck not working to protect me.
Well, one of the big stories you cover in your film is about the real victims of this multi-billion-dollar cover-up, the people who live there and who have suffered in their health. Can you tell us a couple of stories about people and their life and their health impacts?
Yes. During the time of the oil spill, a chemical dispersant known as Corexit was used. It was used to disperse the oil. And when I say disperse, it means to, you know, fan it out in the water. The theory was this would help it break down microbially. It would make it go away. But what actually occurred is when oil is sprayed with Corexit, it becomes something that then can penetrate skin cells, specifically red blood cells. The Corexit was sprayed from planes. It was dumped from boats. And so there it is in the surf, mixing into the air. If you've ever been to the beach, you'll know, boy, there's a high level of humidity. There's a lot of water in the air near a beach. And that water stays in the air because of the negative ions. So now we've mixed oil and Corexit with water, and we've put it in the air. That's the air that people are breathing. That's the air that's coming in contact with people's skin. So not long after the use of Corexit began, people began to have rashes, acute asthma, bleeding from the ears. The symptoms went on and on and on. Women were having greater symptoms because of the higher levels of blood flow to the uterus. And so across the Gulf, thousands and thousands of cases, some of them very severe, some deaths, many miscarriages, at least one baby reported malformed, have been reported and largely ignored by the U.S. institutions that correlate to the properties of Corexit. Now, BP claims that it only ever used 2 million gallons of Corexit, much of which was sprayed by the U.S. Coast Guard under the command of BP, again, a foreign corporation commanding a U.S. division of the military. But independent analysis shows that to break the oil up to the level that it has been broken up, about 40 million gallons of Corexit was used. And we have reports of Corexit being used up until recently. So an extremely toxic, it's a neurotoxin, it's a hemolytic. We know that it destroys fetuses, it hurts the red blood cells, it hurts the blood cell-forming organs, the liver, the kidneys, and it can cause death. That was used. And so we see these ongoing symptoms today. People coming out of the Gulf of Mexico have sores, rashes, open-faced, it's a really strange-looking red sore that occurs on people, and it doesn't go away. It doesn't go away with antibiotics, so it's not a bacteria. Viral treatments don't work because it's obviously not a viral. It's a chemical issue.
Those poor people in Louisiana, they've been beaten up and beaten up again. Who are some of the key people you interview in the movie, The Big Fix?
We interview, it was ironic because, you know, we set out to interview people from BP. That was really one of the goals of the movie, but BP would not allow us to even use the footage of the people we interviewed. And even the Coast Guard, under the command of BP, was very confrontational and would come up to our camera people screaming. And, you know, these are armed people screaming at our camera people on public property. We'd be in a parking lot next to a beach. And so who we ended up interviewing were local people and experts on the larger issue, people like attorney Stuart Smith. And Stuart Smith is a Louisiana-based attorney who won the largest toxic tort case against an oil company in the history of the U.S. And those people began to paint a picture of how companies like BP get away with environmental, you know, what we would call environmental terrorism.
Yeah, well, we know the oil industry can play pretty dirty with its critics. Have you had any blowback since?
Well, I think that, you know, largely The Big Fix, the movie itself, has been, you know, people have been afraid to distribute the film. It's been very difficult to get the film seen. You know, a lot of people are going to see it this June through the internet. You can learn more about it at thebigfixmovie.com. That's thebigfixmovie.com. So I think the largest thing that we've seen is a fear to actually cover the subject. You know, that's the number one way that these companies tend to work. They tend to move a lot of money around and convince a lot of people that it's just not a good idea to talk.
Well, we're approaching the end of our time together, but I feel like I'm missing the really big story in this film still. I mean, it feels like a conspiracy so huge it's hard to see, it's hard to even talk about. Is it about how corporate power runs our lives and our minds, or is it about the buyout of supposedly democratic governments, or what do you feel like the center of this is?
Well, you know, the Big Fix is a dark story. It's shocking, it's terrifying, it's upsetting. People leave the movie sometimes enraged. I had one person stop on the highway after watching the movie because they had a panic attack. But the reality is, you know, the night is always coldest and darkest right before the dawn. And I think the Big Fix shows that we've pushed the limits of corruption as far as we can go without just saying, hey, we really have inverted totalitarianism. You know, we really have corporate totalitarianism. We've pushed about as far as we can go. And many of the systems that we were told as kids were open, democratic, you know, fluid, checks and balances, all of these divisions of the U.S. government that were supposed to keep each other in check, have been heavily corrupted by corporate finance. And the people who we put our trust in, like President Obama, who I voted for, and who I'll vote for again this coming election season, even he is not necessarily personally corruptible, but the institutions around him are so easily corrupted that the power of an honest person inside a dishonest system has been mitigated. And so the Big Fix, in essence, is a real call to action. It's a wake-up call. It's a true story. It's a reality check of what's really happened in the Gulf of Mexico, who really called the shots, and what really is happening today. And at the end of the day, it says, don't just sit there. Get up and do something. Get involved in your democracy, whether it's online, whether it's with your money, pulling your 401k and your IRA out of companies that do bad business and putting them into companies that do good business. It's time to reinvigorate America with a new spirit. And I think that's going to happen. And that's really the underlying message of the Big Fix.
Great. Well, our guest is filmmaker Josh Tickell. And could you tell us just one more time how people will be able to see this movie?
Sure. On June 19th, the movie becomes widely available. The easiest way is to go to thebigfixmovie.com, thebigfixmovie.com. But the DVD will be available at Barnes & Noble, on Amazon.com, and of course the movie will be on Netflix and iTunes, all of those popular ways that folks watch movies these days.
I'm going to watch it. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
O heavenly grid, help us spare up thy standard, our chevron flashing bright across the gulf of compromise, standing humble on the rich field of mobile American thinking, here in this shell we call life.
Are you unwilling to sit through the telling of a strange and horrible story? The brief narrative of a man caught in a web of evil?
You heard China is building a coal plant a week, but we hear much less about a wave of giant coal plants being built across India in spite of mass protests. My good friends at the Sierra Club introduced me to a guest who is in the thick of it. Shoma Dutta is the convener of the People's Science Forum in Delhi. He is campaigning against one of the world's largest coal plants, the 4-gigawatt Tata Mundra project, in a port city in the state of Gujarat. That is in northwest corner of India. Shoma Dutta, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
You should presume, please, we know nothing about India's coal rush or the Tata Mundra project, because Western media don't bother telling us this, even though the huge emissions will help us ruin the climate and all living things. Please tell us about Tata Mundra.
See, this is a plant is about the new wave of so-called ultra-mega power plants, and one of the first nine. There are nine already planned. There's the government is taking out the licenses for this to make life easier for the corporates. And even for this, The government of India actually took out the licenses and then handed over to Tata's as a part of a bidding process, whoever is offering the least cost power in a power purchase agreement. And this started in the early 2000s, but finally it started work around 2006-07 when the sanctions were in place. And the first unit is operational now, first unit of 800 megawatt. And these are being promoted in the name of clean energy because these are using supercritical steam technology. These are supposed to reduce the carbon emission, reduce the carbon emission by around 7 to 8% per kilowatt hour or megawatt hour produced. But these are also supposed to be more expensive to build because of the supercritical technology that Indian companies, Indian manufacturing companies don't produce. So for Tata Mundra, a major part of the equipment is coming from Korean companies. So there is a large presence of Korean workers there also. And this is, as I said, this is located not in a city, but this is located in the most ecologically fragile region of the Kutch district. Kutch is the largest district in India. And the particular geological conditions and the ecological conditions are that Kutch is extremely salt desert. The large interior areas of Kutch are salt deserts. So all the economic activities of people, fisher people, salt pan workers, animal husbandry people, all of them are concentrated in the coastal regions. That is the most productive zone of all of Kutch, in all of Kutch. And that is the area where this Tata Mundra huge ultra-mega power plant of 4,000 megawatt is coming up. And this is having huge impact on all these people's livelihoods and their access and rights and all this.
Well, sadly, we are discovering most Western governments work for big financial interests and the fossil fuel companies. How big and influential is the Tata company in India?
See, Tata being the second or third largest in terms of capital market, stock market valuation, is having immense influence. In fact, there are four or five families, including Tata's and Ambani's and Adani's. They, in fact, determine a lot of policy directions in India. And you might also have heard that recently, because India's, the coal we produced in India, that is Coal India Limited, which is a government-owned company, more than 85% of coal in India is produced by that company. Recently, they had to be forced to raise the coal price because the workers' salaries, other costs, all were going up over the last 20 years, and they were not really raising prices anything. So when they announced that coal price increase decision a little bit, these three, four groups met the Prime Minister of India, and they have this kind of access. They can phone up the Prime Minister and meet him, and Prime Minister is the executive head of the government, not the state. The president is largely ceremonial in India. They could phone up the Prime Minister, meet the Prime Minister, and Prime Minister gave a guideline to Coal India Limited and the Coal Ministry to roll back the coal price. It's that kind of clout these large corporates, which are basically family-owned, they have in India.
Well, I'd like to get back to the citizen activism. No doubt you've heard about the Occupy movement in North America. What is happening in India with citizen activism? Are there many arrests, and what happens to those people in the legal system?
See, in the Occupy movement in America, there's a difference in between civil society in whether US and Europe and in India. The primary reason being these societies, which we call developed countries or richer countries, here the middle class is in overwhelming majority. So the activism and the larger movement groups that are limited mostly to the middle classes. But in India, the middle class and the upper middle class are really, as a class, they are really the class which is now benefiting from all these large investments in power plants, ports, airports, highways, expressways. So in a sense, the middle and upper middle class in India, they are part of the exploiting class. Whereas the activists, the main activist support also comes out of this middle class, but the larger base of activism is in the poor sections of India. So what is happening in India is, because these poor sections have very little voice, they don't have access to media, many of them can't speak English, and India having 18 different officially recognized languages, many of them don't even know the language, the so-called national language, Hindi. So their access and their voices do not get really reflected in the mainstream media. Neither do they often reach to the powers that are there. So there, this role of the support groups, activists like us, like our groups, which are quite a lot now, they play a critical role in not trying to be the leadership, but trying to bring up the real grassroots leadership into the mainstream, making their voices heard. But there is a difference between, again, I'm emphasizing this, there is a difference between the activism that goes on here, because here they are taken in as part of the larger society, but in India, and not only in India, several such similar countries, the real struggling groups, not the city-based activists, the real struggling groups around the power plants, around the ports, they are of a different class and they are of a different, they are looked upon as somewhat less of equal.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Shumya Dutta from the People's Science Forum in Delhi. We're tracking a new wave of coal plant building in India. But Mr. Dutta, there are still hundreds of millions of people in India without electricity, the poor, as you've talked about, and I've seen many stories about blackouts and lack of electricity there. It's hampering development. Doesn't India need more coal-generating plants?
See, this is a fallacy that we have been told, because we have not really analyzed, even in India, many of the activists are really in two minds, because we have not really analyzed what is happening with all the energy that is being produced. And we have to remember the kind of society India is, the level of urbanization, the level of wealth. Electricity contributes around 14% of our primary energy basket, 1/4. So 86% of our primary energy comes from non-electrical sources. So even if we focus on coal-generated electricity, that will give only less than 1/7 or 1/6, close to 1/7 of our primary energy. Number two, from the time this liberalization, globalization, and privatization started taking hold in India, 91 was the start of the policy, but around 95, 6, 7, this started taking hold. If we take 96, the Indian electricity generating capacity was around 81,000 megawatt. And the number of households in India who had no electricity were around 52%. By 2010, the generating capacity became 186,000, that is 186,000 megawatt. That is more than double the 96 capacity. And the number of households that are still without electricity is around 41%. It has gone down by 14%, whether the power, electrical power generation has gone up by more than 100%, it's about 130%. And the people who are without power earlier, large part of them are still without power today. Where the power has gone is basically the new upcoming shopping malls, huge glittering offices, the air conditioning of upper class and middle class houses. And this trend is continuing, because we have to understand a very critical deficiency difference in India and similar societies. The deprivation is not primarily because of physical absence of energy. The deprivation is economic. Even if we generate energy at even fairly low cost, forget about what coal prices go up or down. Even if we generate energy at the present cost, 50% of Indians will not be able to buy that energy. So our policy needs to be targeted towards universal access rather than more generation. And the second very important aspect here is that If we consider that the coal mining, the coal transportation, and the coal power plants, the kind of devastation they do in the local ecology, India's large percent of Indian poor are still dependent on natural resources. The water sources that the mines contaminate, the salt pans that I am coming from Gujarat, the salt pans or the salt are being contaminated by ash from the coal plants. The large number of animal husbandry people whose access or whose grazing land is being taken over. So these people, even if they get electricity, they have a far larger requirement of having a livelihood, which is dependent on natural resources and free access to the natural commons. So these are the natural commons and natural resources which are being attacked by these large industries, mines. So these are doing far more harm than even if additional 5 or 6 or 10% of the people gets electricity.
I do understand that. Now, you talked about the economy of coal plants, and I note that Indonesia, one of the major coal suppliers to India, has risen its prices to international levels. Can these mega coal projects survive those kind of cost increases?
See, there are two different areas here. Like, definitely the power plants which were contracted to sell power at a fixed price, like the Tata Mundra plant that we are talking about. It has a power purchase agreement with the four state governments at in Indian rupee term, 2.26 rupees per unit, that is per kilowatt hour. With the price increase of both Indonesian and Australian coal, this will be going up. This has gone up, and we had three, four statements coming from Tata Power's management, including the managing director, that at this price, if the governments do not reconsider, this will become a non-performing asset. But we see far deeper meaning in this, because we have seen similar conditions in other areas. Even if the power price goes up by, say, even 30% to 40%, there will still be a demand for power from the upper middle class and middle class and the upcoming factories and the newly urbanized segments, because the urban segments are taking up maximum amount of power. And the other factor is people in urban India, except, say, Delhi or one or two such cities, are still short of power because their power family or per person consumption of electricity and other power has gone up tremendously, which was very low earlier, which is still lower than the world average. But in terms of percentage increase, it is a very fast increase. And they are hungry for more energy. See, instead of one AC, you can have two ACs in your house. And they, because they are short of power, they are paying at a far higher rate for backup power from diesel generators from their enclaves, their societies, their housing societies, than they pay for the government-supplied power or the private company-supplied power, which comes from coal or hydroelectricity. So there is a plasticity. There is a gap which the power companies can still increase, though there will be a shot of protest, there will be demonstration. But for another 50 to 60% of increase, there is still a large unmet demand which people are willing to pay if they are assured power. So I think the idea that this will become unviable by just this power increase in coal cost is rather unfounded. But the trend is very clear that if coal prices keep going up like this, then obviously coal-based power will become more expensive. And the way solar photovoltaics and wind, both prices have come down, are coming down, in another 10 years, I think the situation will turn.
And you're working on other projects other than Tata Mundra?
I am working on many projects, including not only coal. I am also working against two, three of the largest nuclear power plant proposals and Kapdodas coming up. So I am working on several other projects.
Can you tell us about the People's Science Forum? What do you do?
See, this is a kind of platform, all India platform, where a lot of small organizations who deal with local environmental issues, local education issues, local issues on water, who have come together in a platform. We started this in 1992, and we moved around all over India to bring those groups which are not associated with a political party's front organization, who are free, but who needs more capacity, who needs more information, who needs more training. So that kind of platform have been built up over the last 18 or 19 years. And we try to address all kinds of issues, even if there is a local pollution issue, or if our area is suddenly suffering from some agricultural deprivation, we try to generate capacity to investigate that, to bring out, to connect to scientists, to connect to media, and then try to get local people to try to solve that.
And it's not easy. Do you happen to know how many new coal plants are under construction in India, or how many are proposed?
See, in the last 5 years, we have a five-year plan system. And 2012, April, is the beginning of the 12th five-year plan. So before that, in the last 5 years, in the 11th five-year plan, the total new coal power plant sanctioned, that is clearances given, is something like 205,000 megawatts. And you have to understand that we have today, by end of today means 2011 end, we have a total coal-powered electricity capacity of 126,000 megawatts. So in the last 5 years itself, the total sanction is far more than we have been able to build up right from Indian independence. So that's a mad rush for sanctions. But what we see in India is this is not just for power. For all the power plants, there is a connection with mines, with land. And India, what is also happening is, in most of these areas, what we call quote-unquote development, the land prices are shooting up extremely fast. So many of these companies are also targeting, supposing they need 200 hectares for the plant, and they will ask for 1,200 hectares. So what they do is they build a plant, but around that they build township, they build other malls, they build other commercial enterprises. So this is a hugely profitable business. Land is a hugely profitable business. And unfortunately, land and all that comes on land, water and forest and grasslands, these are also extremely essential for the poor extraction of people. So that's where the conflicts are coming in far more intensity.
But is India not being struck with climate change-related events like droughts and floods and heat waves the way we are?
India is hit by, in fact, India is one of the 12 most vulnerable countries, if you have seen the studies, out of all the countries in five categories of climate change. And we have done some climate impact studies in the same state in Gujarat, where this Tata Mundra is, in the extreme west of Gujarat. We have done a climate impact study in 2010. We have done climate impact studies in a couple of Himalayan states, Himachal Pradesh, and also in central India, in Madhya Pradesh, and in northeastern state. There are things happening which are very, very alarming. But the problem is, these these are all creeping disasters. These are not spectacular disasters you can see in seconds or minutes or even days. These are creeping disasters. So even though there are a large number of disasters happening, the kind of disaster like a huge cyclone, that's not happening too far. Not too many of these are visible. But what is happening is particularly three aspects. Last 3 years, we have seen the Himalayan rivers, particularly the small streams, drying up much faster, much faster. So that is impacting the agriculture there. But that's not a disaster which the media is interested in. The second aspect is, in large parts of India, the agricultural productivity, particularly of wheat, they have gone down by 3, 4, 5%. And that's a disaster for the people, the families which are on the survival margin. It's not a disaster for large farmers who have access to irrigation, but 60% of Indian farmers do rain-fed farming. They have no money to do irrigation, neither do they have access to water for irrigation. So they are rain-fed farmers. So for them, these are disasters. But for the media and for the larger climate change community, they probably don't see them as disasters, neither do the Indian government.
Well, if India cannot go ahead with coal, what can she do?
See, we have this question have been asked to me by many, many groups and many professors in India that we don't have. In fact, there have been scholarly articles written in Indian journals that India don't have enough renewable energy. I'll just give you one example for calculation. I'm not proposing a huge renewable energy plan because renewable energy by its very nature is distributed. Human needs are distributed. So renewable energy is best exploited in a distributed fashion. But just as an example for calculation, the extreme western part of India, not too far from where Tata Mundra is the Thar Desert. It's a reasonably big desert. The Indian part, it has two parts, one in Pakistan, one part in India. The Indian part itself is more than 100,000 square kilometers, well over 100,000 square kilometers. And the conservative estimate there is around 35 megawatts per square kilometer. You have to remember that more than half of this has very little economic activity because it's a desert. It has very little heavy habitations, very sparsely distributed habitations. And except a few animal grazing, not much economic activity take place in most of the areas. Supposing we take just less than half of this area, supposing, just for calculation, 50,000 square kilometer, and cover it with solar photovoltaic plants. How much electricity can we generate? This is something like, even if I calculate at 30, that is 1.5 million megawatts, which is roughly 8 times India's today's installed total electricity capacity. And this is, I'm talking about just from one small area of India, the existing capacity is there. So this question that India do not have renewable potential is entirely wrong. In the same area where Tata Mundra has come in, if you go to Tata Mundra plant, visit that, on the northern side of that, there are a large number of wind turbines installed. I think something like 500 megawatt of wind power is there in that area. And there is potential for hugely much more. So instead of having these very destructive coal power plants, what we are suggesting is, though the price of solar is still higher, but by the time all this investment, new investment comes in, maybe in another 5, 6, 10 years, by that time both wind will definitely be more competitive. Even solar, like solar concentrated solar thermal, is becoming competitive. Even solar photovoltaic in 10 years will become competitive. So first thing, whether we have enough renewable energy available, yes, we have much more than needed. We have more than 8 to 9 times of total installed capacity available just in a corner of the country. And we think of all the rooftops, think of the southern and central India, where the potential is 25 to 30 megawatt per square kilometer. So we have far more than we need.
How would you advise us to find out more or to support those who want to stop this madness?
There are two categories of people and groups who are really working these who need support. One is the activist groups, the city, the urban activist groups, which are producing material, which are going to these places, which are bringing out these cases to media and to international fora, which are presenting these cases to, say, IFC, World Bank, ADB, wherever, in the international conferences. So one way is to support these groups do this work better, because often being a Indian group and having the Indian government's attitude, you might have noticed recently that any group that takes some support, they are targeted, their licenses are cancelled. Like recently, this largest struggle against the nuclear power plant in Kudankulam, in the southernmost tip of India. All the groups which gave some little support to the fisher people's struggle, they were attacked by their accounts were frozen, their licenses were questioned, they were sort of defamed. So one is to support them with larger international exposure and anyway. And the second more important thing is there are needs for sort of strengthening the grassroots struggles, because that's where the final decision will be taken. Because whatever support we give in terms of intellectual support, in terms of campaign, ultimately it will be the grassroots struggle which will determine what way we go. So those struggles need to be supported in terms of both material, maybe even financed for some of their people to travel and tell about what is happening. So all these are areas where international groups can support, but that they have to choose where they do it, which of the struggles they do it.
We have been talking with Shumya Dutta, who is part of the activist group People Science Forum in Delhi, India. My thanks to Sierra Club India for helping us connect. And thank you so much, Shumya, for joining us on Radio EcoShock. I've just learned so much from you right now.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and I hope this had some impact.
I'm Alex Smith.
Before we go to our exclusive recording of Dr. David Schindler on the tar sands, you'll want to hear this smart new song about a dangerous idea, genetic modification of your food. From YouTube, here is the band Superweed.
The lies of certain sanctuary neath the field of green, where the rhythm of the source resonates with you and me. The multi-corporations are doctoring the pulse with patents on creation. We're ingesting what results. Why do they hype these GM foods? Profits can be genetically improved. Given the right, you know they'll choose to put profit before you. Mother Nature is the essence, the perfect harmony, the purity, the balance, mind and body need. From the cradle her life flows through the blood of nations, though what happens to the river with the source manipulated? Why do they hype these GM foods? Profits can be genetically improved. Given the right, you know they'll choose to put profit before you. Even cash crops propagate the land. And new strains in the food chain lead to pesticide. The ox left its mooring, rivers on the rise. Some things you can't foresee. Riches from the air.
plantation treason. Can you see a sweet harvest in a version of Eden? Why do they hype these GM foods? Profits can be genetically improved. Given the right, you know they'll choose to put profit before you. Why do they hype these GM foods? Profits can be genetically improved. Given the right, you know they'll choose to put profit before you.
That was Superweed with their GM food song. Find it on YouTube. A few weeks ago, I played you part of a daring speech by one of Canada's most prominent and honored scientists, Dr. David Schindler. He spoke about the many dangers of the Canadian tar sands in a speech to a packed audience at the WASC Center in Vancouver. Here is David Schindler wrapping up about the deformed fish, the fake restoration promoted on TV, and the lasting cost to us all.
Native people have been complaining since the early 90s about deformed and malformed fish in the area, as have two Western scientists, one who works for fisheries and oceans and the other who's a private consultant, both of whom have worked in the Delta area since the mid-1970s. So we put in a freezer at Fort Chip and some forms up there and taught the nursing station person to fill out the form so that we could record where people caught these fish. And in 1 year, this is what we got. This is a lake whitefish that was taken in the area. Nice big tumor on it. Here's another one with a deformed spine. Here's a pike with two tails. Another whitefish with lots of big hematomas on them. Mouth and eye deformities were recorded in some of their studies. Here's an adult of these. Here's another tumor, this time on a burbot. And here's a super walleye. Only one eye is this size, but bet this guy can see really well at night, at least out of one side of his head. These were all the sorts of things that were recorded in the embryos. And the people say they only get these deformities when the fish are coming down the river. If they're coming off the lake, they don't get them. So my guess is these are just these deformed embryos growing up. They're probably low in contaminants because these fish do most of their growing in the lake, not in the river. But would you buy these at Safeway? So it probably doesn't matter if they're contaminated. People up there don't eat them. Some of them won't even feed them to their dogs. So the subsistence living that we guaranteed those people with Treaty 8 is pretty well gone. Reclamation is another issue. This is what the area looks like from the air. This is what my wife, who took this photo, would call a wooded fen. And she actually works on reclamation for a couple of the oil sands companies. This is what it looks like on the ground. She and her students have recorded 300 species in these wooded fens of plants and animals. When they're done with this, and put it back, this is the example they're proudest of. If you want to see a funny YouTube that is very popular in our botany department, look up one by Patrick Moore a few weeks ago touring Syncrude's Gateway project. He says, what a wonderful reclamation this is, that this was once a mine. Well, it wasn't a mine. This was clean overburden that was pushed off where they put the mine. So some of the salinity and pollution problems don't occur in this. He points to a little yellow flower to tell how beautiful it was. This yellow flower happens to be an exotic, and it's noted for being high in cyanide. So needless to say, this is a very popular video in botany classes, but not for reasons that the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers would think. I'll come back to this in a minute on costs. This is an actual reclaimed forest in the area, and this is the best sort of wetland they can get after 20 years of trying. This has 17 species in it rather than 300. And the study that we just published last week, 7 years of 2010 emissions of carbon would be worth $2.5 billion as carbon storage in natural capital at the sort of going rate for carbon storage going these days. They show you the success stories. They don't show you photos like this of huge gully erosion running through these. These sediments, when they're done, are kind of like jello. They're clay, and there's a lot of water in them, and they're very unstable. And here you have a bunch of engineers scratching their heads about how to improve this. They're putting in big blocks of peat, and they have things on TV showing you these blocks of peat, and they're nice and green now. But it's well known that those peat plants don't tolerate high salinity. This is about 100 units, and that's the average for peatlands in the area. You can get the best of the oil sands disturbed land is up here at about 1,000 in conductivity, and their pits are up about here. You could put in saline wetlands like you'd find around marine systems or closed basins lake in Saskatchewan, but that's not what they're trying to put in. They're trying to reconstruct ecosystems that will only tolerate this salinity in systems that have this for salinity. So needless to say, they're going to fail. And on TV, you'll hear time after time how they're going to put it back just the way it was. Well, this is a map from our paper that just came out. The gray and brown areas here are the peat and the wooded peat areas that you saw in that photo. This is what they'll put back. The only wetlands will be these long, narrow things. The rest will all be upland, and there will be a little bit of riparian around this end pit lake. These end pit lakes are another disgusting thing. What they're allowed to do is to fill the last mine pit half full of tailings and then pump 10 meters of water over the top of it from the Athabasca River and declare it a lake as replacement fish habitat. And our Federal Department of Fisheries and Oceans has gone along with this 27 times. The first one was approved 17 years ago. There's still no sign that it will support any kind of life, let alone fish. So why do we keep rubber stamping these things without any proof? So altogether, the white area are some of the areas here that I've showed you that they're trying to reclaim. The gray part of this graph, which as you can see is exponential, they're not touching at this point. The amount of money they're putting aside is about 10% of what it costs to put in that gateway buffalo paddock that I showed you on that slide. And that's recognized as an easy site. Guess who's going to pay the reclamation difference? If you're under 40, keep your hand on your wallet. They're coming for you in about 30 years. And as a result of what's going on in those wetlands, lo and behold, this assessment by Environment Canada, not some wild-eyed green group, all of the caribou populations in Alberta are essentially declared uncoverable. And our dear Minister of Environment, when he visited Alberta a few weeks ago, just waved that away, said, well, when the oil sands are reclaimed, we'll stock them from somewhere else in Canada. His excuse for not putting them on the species at risk was, we have lots of caribou in Canada. It doesn't matter if we're missing a few populations in Alberta. There's a film that played on CBC a couple of years ago called Tipping Point, which you can still get up on their website. It gives more of the Aboriginal viewpoint of what's gone on in the area that's kind of interesting to watch.
That was Dr. David Schindler from the WASC Center in Vancouver, recorded by Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. My thanks to Simon Fraser University for permission. The big fix on the Gulf oil spill, the push for coal in India, tar sands propaganda, the fossil fuel industry is flourishing, while the species and the climate thrash towards catastrophe for us all. Now you know, but knowing is only half the battle. The action is up to you and I. Visit our new website at ecoshock.org. Find the blog for this program at ecoshock.info. From Wi-Fi somewhere in America, I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about your world.